The apartment smelled of damp plaster, and the faint sweetness of the tea Alina had been brewing since Vera left a chamomile blend that did nothing to mask the underlying odor of fear, the kind that seeped out of pores and settled into upholstery and lingered long after the person who produced it had gone. Vera stood in the doorway of the kitchen and watched her mother pour water that was no longer boiling into a cup that would no longer be drunk. Alina's hands had stopped shaking, which was worse. When they shook, Vera could do something: cover them with her own, press them against the table, tell her to sit down. Still, hands meant resignation, and resignation was something Vera had no vocabulary for. She set the train tickets on the table beside the sugar bowl and the chipped saucer. The paper rustled against the wood, a sound so small it might have been imagined, but Alina flinched anyway, just slightly, the way a sleeping animal flinches at a dream. "I'm going now," Vera said. Alina did not look at her. She set the kettle down on the stove without turning the flame, her eyes fixed on something beyond the sink, beyond the window, beyond the wall that separated their flat from the rest of the building and the rest of the city and the rest of the world that was no longer theirs. "Before midnight," she said. It wasn't a question. It was an acknowledgement, brittle and thin as ice on a November pond. The kind of understanding that arrives too late to prevent anything, but just in time to make you feel responsible for everything that follows. Vera went to the bedroom. She needed to write something. Not a note for notes could be intercepted, read, analyzed, weaponized by the same machinery that had torn up her suspension order and scattered the pieces across the kitchen table like dead moths. Something that would not exist for anyone but herself. Something that could be destroyed without consequence, because the act of writing it was the only consequence that mattered. She sat at the small desk by the window, the one with the drawer that stuck unless you lifted it slightly while pulling, the one her mother had brought from their old flat on Vinohrady when Vera moved in at 21, when the city still believed it could breathe on its own. She opened the drawer and found a sheet of paper, pale blue at the edges where humidity had softened the fibers, and a pen that still held ink. She uncapped it and held it over the page for a long time, watching the tip gather a droplet that threatened to fall and stain the blank space before she pressed down and made the first mark. "Alina." The word sat on the page like a stone dropped into still water. She stared at it. She had never written a letter to her mother, not really. Their conversations were spoken, immediate, functional: "Have you eaten? Lock the door. Don't answer to strangers." Love in their household had always been expressed through the distribution of food and the repetition of warnings, through the way Alina filled the sugar bowl with things that weren't tea and expected Vera to understand that abundance was the only language of care she knew. A letter implied distance, and distance implied that someone was already gone. "I don't know if you'll ever read this. I don't know if I'll come back. I'm writing it anyway, because there are things I need to say to someone who will not interrupt me, who will not tell me I'm being dramatic, who will not ask me to be practical when practicality has become a form of cowardice." She stopped. The pen hovered. What did practicality look like now? It looked like staying. It looked like accepting the suspension order, filing it away, waiting for the ministry to decide whether she was useful enough to keep or disposable enough to discard. It looked like trusting that her work as a translator, her careful, meticulous rendering of Czech texts into English and back again, was harmless, that the act of making words travel across borders was a neutral gesture, a bridge rather than a weapon. She had believed that. She had believed it for 26 years, since she was a girl sitting at this same desk, translating fairy tales for her school essays, turning Bailey Jednu Try Orishki into English for a teacher who didn't care about the difference between walnuts and hazelnuts, but appreciated the effort. Translation was an act of faith. You trusted that the meaning survived the journey, that the essence of a thing could cross a river without drowning. The tanks had taught her otherwise. She wrote, "When the tanks came, I stood at the window and watched them roll down Karlova Ulice like the closing of a sentence I had been trying to finish for months. I told myself I was observing, maintaining the detached gaze I applied to every manuscript carefully, scanning for syntax errors and hidden meanings. But I was not observing. I was waiting for the translation to begin. I was waiting for someone to tell me what it meant. No one did. That was the point, I think. The meaning was supposed to be obvious. The tanks were the meaning. Everything else, the smoke, the soldiers in their greatcoats, the way the street lamp flickered at 6:47 as though it were trying to send a signal. Everything else was just commentary. Her thumb throbbed. She looked down and saw that the scab had cracked again, a thin red line tracing the edge of her skin where the paper had bitten into her wound. She pressed her palm flat against the desk, feeling the vibration of the printer below through the wood, through her bones, through the floorboards that concealed the satchel and its contents, and the weight of a manuscript that was not hers, and yet was the only thing she had ever truly carried. "Paper is heavier than lead," Jiri had said. She had not understood then. She understood now. Lead was a physical weight, measurable, quantifiable. You could put it in a pocket and feel it drag at the fabric. Paper was different. Paper accumulated. Every page you carried added not just grams, but consequences, not just mass, but memory, not just weight, but the terrifying knowledge that someone somewhere had written these words hoping they would survive you. "I am carrying something that is not mine," she wrote. "I am carrying the words of people I have never met, in a language I did not create, hidden beneath floorboards in an apartment that the ministry has already decided does not belong to me. I am a translator. My job is to make things understandable. But I do not understand what is happening to me. I do not understand why Colonel Hansel visited Mama yesterday and sat at our kitchen table and asked her about my loneliness as though it were a security concern. I do not understand why he spoke so politely, so gently, the way a man speaks to a child who is drawn on the walls with crayon and needs to be told, kindly, that this is not allowed." Alina's face rose in her mind's eye, pale, composed, the face of a woman who had spent 58 years mastering the art of appearing unremarkable. She had lied to Hansel. She had told him Vera was in Brno visiting a sick aunt. Vera had heard the echo of her mother's voice in the hallway when she returned from the ministry, still trembling from the encounter, still replaying the conversation in her head like a gramophone needle stuck on the same groove. "My daughter is in Brno," Alina had said, and the words had come out clean, certain, the way a woman speaks when she is lying with every fiber of her being and believes, genuinely believes, that truth is whatever keeps her child alive. "She has been ill for 2 days. Fever. I thought you should know so you wouldn't worry when she doesn't come home." Hansel had nodded. He had smiled. He had asked about the fever, about the aunt, about whether Vera's mother needed anything, tea, medicine, company, and Alina had said no, 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 the way a mother says no when offering is a form of surrender, and she had already surrendered everything she could afford to surrender. And then Hansel had stood, adjusted his coat, and said, "Tell your daughter that the ministry remembers those who are loyal. We are not interested in punishing people for mistakes. We are interested in preserving what matters. Tell her that, if she wishes to speak to someone." He had not mentioned the manuscript. He had not mentioned the satchel. He had not mentioned anything that could be used as evidence. He had mentioned loyalty, preservation, mercy, the vocabulary of a man who understood that the most effective threats are the ones that sound like invitations. Vera wrote, "Mama lied to him. She lied to a colonel of the ministry, to a man whose job was to extract information and whose power extended far beyond the walls of the building on Wenceslas Square. She lied with both hands shaking and her voice steady, and I think she may have been more terrified in that moment than she has ever been in her entire life. And for what? For me. For a daughter who is leaving tonight and may never return, carrying a burden that was never hers to bear." She paused. The pen had begun to skitter across the paper, the ink drying at the tip, leaving gaps in the letters like teeth missing from a smile. She pressed harder, forcing the remaining ink onto the page, and continued. "I am afraid." The sentence was simple. It was honest. It was the truest thing she had written in months. Fear clings to her like the damp wool of her coat, thickening with every mile toward Cheb. She dreads the floodlights that will bleach the color from the world, the dogs straining against their leashes, and the soldiers whose eyes slide over her papers as if they are nothing more than refuse. She fears the woods, to a place she knows only from folklore, smelling of rotting pine, and a silence so profound it feels like being erased rather than hidden. And then there is Lucas, whose twitchy eyes and staccato speech betray a man fraying at the edges. He looks at her not as a person, but as contraband, a package he has been ordered to move, his gaze uncertain whether she will break or explode under the weight of what she carries. I am afraid of burning the manuscript. I am afraid of keeping it. I am afraid of neither option being sufficient. The ministry wants it. Jiri wants it. Lucas wants it. I want it. In the way a person wants their own heart to have it removed from the body and preserved intact, displayed for anyone who cares to look, proof that I was alive, that I felt, that I believed in something large enough to risk everything for. I am afraid that when I reach the border and the floodlights hit my face, and the soldier raises his rifle and asks me to open my coat, I will understand, finally, what it means to choose between preservation and survival. And I will find that the choice is not a choice at all, but a theft. Either I steal myself from the manuscript and live with the theft, or I steal the manuscript from myself and die with it. She set the pen down. The ink had dried on the page, the letters sharp and permanent, as though the paper itself had absorbed the confession and would not release it. She read what she had written once, slowly, the way you read a poem you are about to translate, looking for the word that changes everything, the sentence that carries the weight of the whole text, the phrase that, if removed, would make the rest collapse. There was no such word. There was no single sentence that contained the fear. The fear was distributed across the page like salt across bread everywhere, necessary, invisible until you tasted it. She folded the letter once, twice, three times, until it was a small rectangle that fit into the palm of her hand. She considered hiding it somewhere inside the desk drawer, beneath the mattress, in the lining of her coat, but there was no safe place. Nothing was safe. The apartment had been searched. The ministry had torn her suspension order to pieces and scattered them on the kitchen table. Hansel had visited her mother and offered her mercy in the form of a threat wrapped in politeness. The city was occupied, and occupation was a slow process of erasure, like ink fading from paper left in sunlight, like memories dissolving when you stop telling them to anyone. She put the letter in her coat pocket. It pressed against her side like a second heart, smaller and quieter than the real one, but beating in the same rhythm. She stood and walked to the window one last time. The street below was empty. The fog had returned, thick and gray, swallowing the rooftops and the chimney pots and the narrow alley that led to the printer's shop. The street lamp had not yet flickered. It was too early for 6:47, though time had become unreliable, stretching and contracting like a rubber band pulled too tight. Somewhere in the building, a neighbor's television crackled through the walls, the static-laced voice of a newsreader announcing something Vera could not hear and did not want to. The printer's rollers churned below, a mechanical heartbeat indifferent to the suffocation above. 4 o'clock and midnight remained the only coordinates that mattered, collapsing a life into a single, sharp point of departure. She thought of her mother in the kitchen, sitting in the dim light, counting tea packets that would never be brewed, surrounded by the chipped saucer and the sugar bowl and the quiet, desperate arithmetic of a woman who had nothing left to offer her daughter except the hope that she would survive. Vera pressed her forehead against the cold glass and closed her eyes. She did not cry. Crying was for people who believed there would be a tomorrow to dry their eyes. She stood there in the gathering dark, her hand in her coat pocket resting on the folded letter she would never send, listening to the silence with the same careful attention she once gave to poems, waiting for the word that changes everything. The radiator hissed, the printer below had stopped, the city exhaled. The secret remained pressed flat against the wood, a silent burden waiting for the morning shift to begin.